Professor Velina Beatty has talked about an astonishing statistic. Currently, about 75% of exonerated women were wrongfully convicted of a crime that never occurred. Let that number sink in. 3 out of 4 women who have been set free were wrongfully convicted for a crime that no one committed. Common examples include a husband who died in his sleep, a loved one who died by suicide, and the type of case we're covering this season, a child who lost her life in a tragic accident. Professor Beatty chalks up these no-crime wrongful convictions to a combination of factors, all of which you'll hear about this season. Stigma and bias, junk science, and prosecutors who put on the blinders and sometimes don't play by the rules.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, Toward Justice, The State versus Amanda Lewis. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This is the first episode of a deep dive series into the wrongful conviction of Amanda Lewis. Back in 2008, Amanda was convicted of the murder of her daughter, Adriana, and she's been serving a life sentence ever since.
So let's start at the very beginning, in the small town of Estill, Florida. On the afternoon of August 8, 2007, the small town of under 400 in the Sunshine State's panhandle was rocked by a 911 call.
911.
Please.
911.
I need an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
My daughter fell in the pool and she's not breathing.
Where at, ma'am?
In Esto.
Ma'am, what's your address?
3343 First Avenue South.
3343 First Avenue South.
Yes, down the road from the post office at the very end.
What's your phone number, ma'am?
850-263-0759.
And she's not breathing. How old is she?
She's 7 years old.
All right, hang on just a second, ma'am.
Oh, God.
Just a second, ma'am.
Her lips are purple. What do I do?
Ma'am?
Water's just coming out of her nose.
Yes, sir. Ma'am?
Huh?
You said water's coming out of her nose?
Yes, I've got her on her side, and she's coming out of her nose every time I move her.
Okay, hang on just a second.
Please hurry.
Rescue? Yes, ma'am. I've got them on the way. I'm going to see if they can do something to help you. Hang on just a moment. Rescue 1, they're advising they've got her laid over on her side. Water's coming out of her nose. Is there anything they can do until you get to 12? Hang on just a second. Does she have a pulse, ma'am?
No, she's not got nothing. She is purple.
She don't. Hang on just a second.
Everything's purple.
She's advising she's purple, no pulse, no breathing. Hang on just a second, ma'am. Ten four. Okay, ma'am, I've got rescue on the way, and I'm fixing to get you someone else, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to call you right back in just a few minutes. Ma'am?
Huh?
We've got them on the way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Amanda Lewis making the 911 call. She was a 27-year-old certified nursing assistant who worked in nearby Bonifay, just south of Estill. Everyone agrees that Amanda made the call just after pulling her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana, out of the family's pool while her 6-year-old son, AJ, watched. It was a blue sand and sun easy set 18-foot by 4-foot pool, meaning the above-ground pool had an 18-foot diameter and was 4 feet deep. To form a visual, it was a blue, round, inflated, soft-sided pool that sat on a slight slope. Its water was measured at about 32 inches deep on one side, 35 and a half inches on the other side after Adriana had been pulled from the pool. The pool was behind and somewhat to the side of the double-wide trailer where Amanda, Adriana, and AJ lived, so it was visible from the lightly traveled dirt road they lived on. Amanda made this two-minute 911 call at about 2:36 p.m., and this is where living in a small town can work in your favor. Charles Corcoran, the chief of the Esto Fire Department, got the dispatch call about the drowning at 2:39 p.m. and was on the scene with two other firefighters a mere 3 minutes later. The first of the three to arrive was Gary Jacobs, another firefighter who drove a fire truck and manned the pump. According to Jacobs, he came upon Amanda giving CPR to her daughter.
I was first born in the chief and in Jose.
Did you tell the jury what you saw when you arrived on the scene?
Yes, sir. When we got there, Amanda was down with a little girl. Looked like she was trying to give her CPR.
When Chief Charles Corcoran arrived shortly thereafter, he sent Amanda in to get towels and began his own attempts at CPR.
What did you do at that point?
I told the mother to go get me some towels, and I asked her the question on how long she was in the pool. I told her I also wanted a blanket. I knelt down. I did the initial diagnosis that you make in that kind of a situation. I looked at the entire line of the body, looked at the pupillary response, looked at the mouth contents, straightened out the neck, which is called hyperextension, pushed the forehead and the head back, gave breaths, and started compressions.
Beyond performing these life-saving measures, Corcoran took tabs on three things. First, he saw a single small bruise at Adriana's hairline that we'll discuss in detail in a later episode. And second and third, while there was no ladder to climb into and out of the pool, a bicycle and a small red wagon were standing to the side of the pool, essentially right next to it. All of this led to Corcoran's clear conclusion that Adriana had been on the bike or in the wagon when she leaned over and fell in due to the lack of resistance in these types of pools.
Now, you had noticed that injury to the child's forehead, sir. Did you see anything in the area that could have maybe caused that injury?
Yes, I did.
Because you were the first person to arrive, the first rescue personnel to arrive. What, if anything, did you see in that area, sir?
In the photos of the pool, you see a wagon and you see a bicycle. It was my assumption at that point that the child was up on either of those two toys. That type of a pool has no resistance when you put weight on it. It's water supported. My assumption was she went over the side of the pool, went down, hit her head, and came back up.
While living in the cozy confines of a small town led to first responders being on site in mere minutes, Esto's small size also meant that Adriana had to be taken to a bigger city to be treated. EMTs arrived about 7 minutes after the first responders. They did their own life-saving measures for about 10 minutes as a site was prepped so that Adriana could be medevaced via helicopter to a hospital in Panama City. Luckily, the EMTs were able to restore Adriana's heartbeat, but it was touch and go. Here's EMT Shay McCormick testifying at trial.
Did she get a heartbeat, sir? Do you know?
After about two more cycles of CPR, we stopped and we did have a heartbeat on the child.
Then, somewhere between 3:01 and 3:07 p.m., a life flight helicopter landed at the prepped site. Adriana was taken into the aircraft and treated by a team led by paramedic Sharon Thomas, who took over life-sustaining measures.
We maintained the CPR that had already been started, and they had already intubated the lungs, so what we did was we just breathed for them and circulated, and then we gave, I think, two or three drugs, epinephrine and atropine, I believe.
The helicopter took off at 3:18 p.m. and was in the air for 28 minutes before landing at Bay Medical Center in Panama City at 3:46 p.m. Once there, Adriana was taken to an operating room where she was treated by emergency room physician Linda Fox starting at 4:19 p.m. By this point, any pulse had faded, but Dr. Fox was able to restore it again and had hope for a while before things took a turn for the worse.
Did you see any improvement, or were you able to actually get a heartbeat or a pulse rate that afternoon, ma'am?
After we'd gone through about probably almost between 8 to 10 medications, dosing of bicarb, epinephrine, adrenaline, these kind of medications that we use, we did get some cardiac activity back. I actually got a pulse without compressions, and I thought we were going to bring her back.
I
believe at some point you say you quit the chest compressions and she was placed on a ventilator. Is that right?
We had her on a... She was intubated from the time she came through the door, and she always had somebody either breathing for her or the machine was hooked up to her. And we were trying to get the machine hooked up to her when she started having spontaneous pulse back. We were trying to put her on a established machine so that we could get her ready to stabilize and transfer her. And at that point, I'd already been in contact with Tallahassee Memorial in the phone in the room, and I'd been talking to a critical care pediatrician that I'd like to refer to and ask questions to.
So you had this spontaneous pulse there, and can you give us an idea of how long that lasted, Dr. Fox?
Not long enough for me to... She had a pulse, and I looked up and I talked to the people in the room, and I was going to leave the room to talk to the pediatrician to set up transfer. And I just got him on the phone when she lost her pulse again. It hadn't been 2 or 3 minutes.
And so, about 2.5 hours after Amanda made the 911 call, her daughter Adriana was declared dead at 5:05 p.m.
I can tell you the code was called at probably 5 after, by my notes, and...
5 after 5, or...?
5 after 5.
Okay.
Just around the same time as Adriana was declared dead, something else was going on. To get there, let's rewind to the scene of the drowning. Shortly after Adriana was taken away in the helicopter, Chuck Burns arrived at the double-wide trailer. Chuck was married to Amanda's mother, Brenda, and he got a phone call from her on his way home from work about what had happened. Chuck drove to the scene, where arrangements were being made to transport Amanda to Bay Medical Center. The thinking was it would be too traumatic to have AJ accompany his mother after seeing his sister drown. And so, Chuck got permission to drive AJ to the home that he shared with Brenda in nearby Alabama.
As a result of that, did you or your wife make arrangements to take care of AJ Hutto that day?
Yes, I did.
Tell us about that, sir.
I spoke with the sheriff, and he told me I could take him, and I told him to, you know, take him to the house, and I took him to the house.
He rode with you?
Right.
What does he refer to you as, sir?
Paul Chuck.
According to Chuck, AJ told him some very important information about the drowning during this trip. In turn, this led to Chuck making the decision to call the authorities.
On the way to the house, did you have a conversation with him?
Yes.
All right. Now, after you got home, as a result of that conversation, what did you do?
I talked with his grandmother, Brenda, and we called the sheriff's department and brought him down here.
So Chuck and Brenda drove AJ to the sheriff's department, where they were taken to an interrogation room. This happened at 5:09 p.m., mere minutes after Adriana was declared dead, and about 2.5 hours after AJ saw his sister drowning. AJ was bookended by his grandmother, Brenda, and her husband, Chuck, in the interrogation room. Also in that room were Chief Deputy Harry Hamilton and Sergeant Mike O'Reilly, who had become the lead agent on the case. AJ's mother, Amanda, was not in the room, nor had she given consent for the interrogation of her son. And there was also no one from the Child Protection Team present, nor anyone with training on how to talk to a traumatized child. The officers started the interrogation by asking AJ some preliminary questions. Then, they turned to what AJ just told Chuck during their car ride. To set that story up, recall that Amanda was a certified nursing assistant. She worked the night shift from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. and actually had a mandatory meeting at work that day, meaning she didn't get home until around 8 a.m. Then, she took a nap at about 9:30 a.m., and everyone agrees that she slept for a few hours. Where AJ and Amanda differ is regarding why Amanda woke up. Here we'll hear AJ's version, with Mike O'Reilly starting the substantive portion of the interrogation by asking what AJ told Chuck during their car ride, prompting AJ to respond as follows.
My sister, she read me and spray something that makes everything smell good, and she done the stuff that she didn't post to, so my mama got mad, so she threw her in the pool. And then she told her to go somewhere, and she said no, because Mom was going to dunk Ogie. And then Mom had to go get in the car to go get Adrian. And then Adrian was trying to escape from Mama, and then Mama pulled her back in the car. And then once they got back home, Mama threw her back in the pool. And then she started drowning again.
Adriana started drowning?
And then when she had to take a shower, my mama told me to go get her. And then when I was standing in the wagon, she was dead.
AJ ended up changing critical parts of his story of what he saw at least 13 times. But this is the core story that the state would try to sell at trial. First, that Amanda became enraged when she was woken up by Adriana spraying something she wasn't supposed to spray. Now, notably, in this very first accounting, AJ said that Adriana sprayed something that made everything smell good. But later during this interrogation, and ultimately at trial, that story shifted to her spraying something that smelled bad, and we'll explain in a later episode why that shift was significant. Next, we have the second part of AJ's core story, which is that Adriana then did some other stuff she wasn't supposed to do, waking up Amanda twice more after she'd gone back to sleep. Specifically, AJ said that Amanda sent Adriana to her room for the spraying incident. Then, Amanda went back to sleep, but was awakened by AJ, who told her that Adriana had left her room to watch TV. According to AJ, Amanda again sent Adriana back to her room before going back to sleep herself. Finally, AJ said that Amanda was awakened a third time by Adriana slamming some cabinet doors. Here's AJ explaining all this to the police officers.
Did your mama go back to bed?
Only when Adrian was in trouble.
Only when she was in trouble? Where was she at when she was in trouble?
In Amber's old bedroom.
Why'd she get in trouble in there?
Because she messed with the spray.
She messed with the spray? Did somebody tell her to go into the room?
Mama did.
And did she do it? Then what happened?
She came out again because she wanted to watch TV. And then I told Mom that Adrian's out the room.
And what did your mama do?
She told me to go back in the bedroom.
And then what?
And then, when I went back to sleep, watching TV, she thought that I wasn't watching her. And I was watching her because I heard the cabinet open and shut. She slammed the cabinet door.
Who did?
Adrian.
Third, according to AJ, this repeated misbehavior by Adriana that kept waking up Amanda led Amanda to dunk Adriana in the family pool a first time as a form of punishment. Fourth, AJ said that Amanda then told Adriana to go somewhere. In this first version of this story, AJ said that Amanda sent Adriana to the school bus stop so she could be picked up.
Where did she go?
I think she had to go to the bus stop and wait till somebody picked her up.
And all this was today? Where's the bus stop at?
It's close to where our house is.
Is that where do y'all have to ride the bus from there, or?
Well, we had to go to Papa Springs.
Okay.
You might have caught the incredulity in Michael Raley's voice as he asked AJ whether this had happened today. Because recall, this drowning happened on August 8th, which was during the summer, when school was not in session. Specifically, school at Poplar Springs, which is where AJ said the school bus took them. And at another point during the interrogation, AJ made even more direct reference to Adriana and he going to school on both the day of the drowning as well as the day before.
Do you know when? When you went to school? When?
Well, My mom was at home sleeping, and then when we got done from school, she picked us up at the car stop.
You know when? Was that today? What about yesterday?
Now, you can't hear AJ's response to the last two questions, but the video very clearly shows him nodding yes. In other words, AJ was saying yes, we went to school yesterday, and yes, we went to school today, with our mom picking us up from school when she woke up. Later in the interrogation, though, AJ returned to his story of their mom waking up and dunking Adriana in the pool the first time. He also subsequently shifted his story to say that Amanda sent Adriana to a nearby park, with this then becoming the fourth part of his core story that would be told at trial. In turn, this sets up the fifth part of AJ's core story, that Amanda had AJ retrieve her car keys and sandals so she could get in her Chevy Cavalier and bring Adriana home. Next, the sixth part of AJ's core story is that there was a struggle between Amanda and Adriana as Adriana tried to escape when Amanda was taking her home. Then, there's the seventh part of AJ's core story, that upon bringing Adriana home, Amanda threw her in the pool and fatally drowned her. And finally, there's the eighth part of AJ's core story, that at some later point, he and Amanda were away from the pool, with Amanda telling AJ to get Adriana so she could take a shower, followed by AJ finding Adriana dead in the pool.
As we said, this was the core story by AJ, and it is the one that the prosecution would use to frame the case against Amanda at the start and end of her murder trial. Hey, Undisclosed listeners, we are going to take a quick ad break, and I just want to explain something to you about why it's so important for you guys to support our sponsors. You might not know this, but all these years, all the work we have done for all of the defendants whose cases we reinvestigate and cover has been pro bono. We don't charge them or their families or their lawyers a dime. And the only way we can afford to do this, which this is work that would ordinarily cost a defendant hundreds of thousands of dollars, the only way we can afford to do this is because of our sponsors. So we are so grateful to our sponsors, and we are grateful to all of you. If you want to know what you can do to help support our work, support our sponsors. Thank you so much. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some parts of parenting get easier. Like, you can finally have real conversations, they can grab their own snacks, they might even clean up after themselves on a good day. But there are some things that never get easier, like teaching them about money. And the truth is that kids won't truly learn to manage money until and unless they get hands-on experience. That is where Greenlight comes in. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on kids' spending and saving while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun, accessible way. The Greenlight app also includes a chores feature, which is awesome, where you can set up one-time or recurring chores customized to your family's needs and reward kids with an allowance for a job well done. And you too can set up the Greenlight app to cover whatever chores it is you need to incentivize your kids to do. Millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. We use the Greenlight app to reward a couple of different chores that are now my son's responsibility, and he actually loves doing them, so he can watch his balance go up every time he does his chores, like take out the trash, clean up the cat's litter, and make the bed. Now, for an almost 9-year-old, not too shabby. So don't wait to teach your kids real-world money skills. Start your own risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/toward justice. That's greenlight.com/toward justice to get started. greenlight.com/toward justice. Hi, everybody. Rabia here. I am so excited to tell you, if you haven't heard yet, that Undisclosed finally has a Patreon. Our Patreon is where you will find all kinds of perks like ad-free episodes, a bonus episode every month where Colin and I answer all your questions, and also you're going to find perks like early access to our limited merch drops, which are going to start happening twice a year, as well as the ability to get on a Zoom call with me once a month, face to face, to live discuss any true crime case that you guys are obsessed with and really want to go through. And I love having a place to talk about that stuff because I need people to talk about it with. But if you're not in it for the perks and you're in it for the justice and you just want to support our work, I would really ask you to please sign up for the dollar a month tier. And the perk there is just good karma and warm fuzzies and being in the fight for justice for these defendants, because if everybody chips in a dollar a month, our work can be funded for another decade to come. So check out the Undisclosed Patreon by going to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Again, it's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And I hope to see you all there. Thank you for supporting our work for a decade, and please stay with us so we can do this for years to come. Here's Prosecutor Larry Basford laying things out for the jury in his opening statement, picking up just after the first dunking incident.
Adriana gets in an argument with her mother. Adriana ends up walking away, going down the road, headed to the park. When her mother finds out about this, she tells AJ, get my keys, get my shoes. And she gets in the car, a red car, and she goes down the road to get Adriana. Now, AJ is staying there at the house. So we don't know what happened down the road, but when she gets back, she is continuing, she being the defendant, is continuing to argue with Adriana. At this point, her frustration has reached the breaking point. She's tired. She's frustrated. Adriana did not take her medicine that morning because the defendant forgot to give her her medicine that morning. So she takes her over to the pool. And then you will hear what happens when she got over to the pool that morning. You will hear that she put Adriana in the pool, and how Adriana was screaming, and AJ could hear Adriana screaming. You will hear also how AJ saw his mother dunk his sister into the pool. Not only will you hear how he saw the defendant dunk his sister, you will hear him describe how he saw the defendant, his mother, place her hand over Adriana's face and push her head in the water as she was screaming.
So from this opening statement, we pick up two more morsels of the state's theory of the case. First, they wanted to sell the story of Amanda as an exhausted mother at the end of her rope, with Adriana's repeated misconduct as she tried to sleep being the last straw that pushed her over the edge. And second, as you heard from Basford's opening, Adriana had ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which the state claimed contributed to Amanda feeling overwhelmed in trying to handle her. Turning to Basford's closing argument, we can hear him hitting all of the core chronology of AJ's story, as well as the additional point that Adriana was terrified of the water.
This is a woman that was trying to get some sleep. But she couldn't that day because Adriana was not on her medication. Adriana was not staying in a room. In fact, she was in slamming cabinets and spraying stuff. This is a woman who was tired. This is a woman who was frustrated. This is a woman who had tried all types of discipline to get Adriana to mind. She had tried grounding her. She had tried taking away her toys. She had tried spanking her. But this time, she was going to try something different to get her attention. She was going to dunk her in that pool. If you do that one more time, I'll dunk you in the pool. This is the ultimate punishment. She knew how afraid Adriana was of water. And what happened? Did Adriana mind? No. So she took her outside, and she went outside and dunked her in the pool. Then what happened? Adriana walked away from the pool. She started walking down the road, and her mother got in the car and went and got her, brought her back. You heard that there was an argument when she brought her back. Adriana didn't want to go. But she kept pulling her in the car, got her back to the house, and then what did she do? She went over there and dumped her again.
Of course, all of this makes it sound like AJ took the witness stand at trial and told a story that was very much like the story he told the police officers hours after Adriana died. But the bottom line is that he didn't. Instead, when he took the witness stand, it seemed like he knew nothing at all, and it took a series of leading questions to start taking him in the right direction, although even this ended up being a dead end. Here's the very start of the substantive questioning of AJ by Bassford at trial.
What happened to Adriana when your mother woke up?
She got grounded.
All right. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tell us about that.
I can't remember.
You can't remember?
No, sir.
Were you inside or were you outside?
Inside.
Did you go outside that day?
No, sir.
Now, at some point, did you and Adriana go outside to play that day?
Yes, sir.
What were y'all playing?
Tractors.
Tractors?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Where were you playing with those tractors, AJ?
I can't remember.
All right. How is it that Adriana got drowned that day, AJ? Can you tell me?
No, sir.
All right. Let me ask you some other questions then.
So here you hear AJ saying he cannot remember anything about the drowning, how he didn't see what happened, how he was inside when all this went down. Now listen, it's heartbreaking to hear this child on the witness stand being asked to tell a courtroom full of people how his big sister drowned in the pool. And for the record, AJ is only 7 years old when he takes the stand. And at the same time, you could easily say that AJ's shifting story and forgetfulness were based on his young age, but also the trauma he experienced in seeing his mother drown his sister. But that logic, which we will question in a later episode, would work both ways. Assume that AJ didn't see Adriana being dunked in the pool and only saw her after she was lifeless on its surface. Moreover, we know for a fact that AJ saw his mom pull Adriana out of the pool and manipulate her face to perform CPR. It's just as easy to say that AJ tried to make sense of what he saw of the aftermath of the drowning, jumping to the conclusion that his mom had killed Adriana rather than trying to save her. So, which take is right? Well, one of the crucial points of dispute between the prosecution and defense was whether AJ was confabulating events from different days or speaking solely about the day Adriana drowned. You already heard one piece of evidence that AJ was combining events from different days. His very first words to the police. Recall that AJ said Amanda sent Adriana to the school bus stop to get picked up, despite the day of the drowning being during the summer break. During the trial, at the end of the last clip, after AJ testified that he didn't know how Adriana got drowned, you heard Larry Bassford say, quote, "Let me ask you some other questions then." This is a classic tactic to get a wayward child witness back on track. Ask him some easy questions about non-traumatic things that definitely happened on the day of the crime to try and jog his memory of more critical things. This then led directly to the following questions.
Did you see any men that day working around your house?
Yes, sir.
What were they working on?
Trees.
Okay. Cutting trees?
Yes, sir.
Where were they doing that?
At my house.
Okay.
This is consistent with something that AJ said during his police interrogation, that the tree cutting on the day of the drowning impacted how he was playing outside.
Where's your wagon at?
It was at the pool, but when a tractor was coming, it cut down the trees. That's why I left it in the foot on the four-wheel trail. That's why I left my wagon.
But there was a major problem with this testimony in the police statement. This tree cutting didn't happen on the day Adriana drowned. Instead, it happened the day before. This chronology was established at trial by the testimony of a man named Scott Kirkland, who said he was bush hogging on the day in question, essentially doing a cleanup operation after the trees had been cut the prior day.
What specifically were you doing that day, Mr. Kirkland?
I was bush hogging.
You were bush hogging?
And in case you're not familiar with bush hogging, here's Scott Kirkland explaining exactly what he did.
Okay, can you describe to the jury what actually you were doing there near his residence?
The little strip of woods there between his yard and the field, they had been through and trimmed the limbs about from the lines or piled up on the ground. It was my job to come in and mulch them up.
In terms of where he was doing this bush hogging, here's what Scott Kirkland said.
Now, you said you were mowing that little strip of land there near that residence. Did you notice anything in the woods near where you were mowing, Mr. Kirk?
Yes, there was a bicycle and a little red wagon there close to where I was mowing.
Okay, so, and how far would that have been where they were located there around 1 o'clock from the pool?
Maybe 35, 40 yards.
You might recall first responder Charles Corcoran testifying that the wagon and bike were right next to the pool when he arrived at 2:42 p.m. So, setting things up for the second episode in the series, at some point between bush hogging and Charles Corcoran's arrival, someone moved the wagon and bike over 100 feet from the wooded area to the pool. Now, turning back to AJ's story, the prosecution tried to claim at trial that AJ was actually describing himself changing the way he played outside because of this bush hogging. Sure, he said the men were cutting the trees, and sure, the trees were cut the day before. But bush hogging by one guy, tree cutting by many men, but it was the same difference to the state.
But there were a few problems with this bait and switch. The first was that Scott Kirkland said he saw no one outside the double-wide trailer when he was doing his bush hogging.
Did you see anybody outside of Mr. Carnley's residence that day as you went to mow?
No, sir.
This is a big problem because AJ definitely described himself as being in a place where Scott Kirkland would have seen him. And while Kirkland didn't testify to this directly at trial, he made clear in his police statement that he was specifically looking around to make sure that no kids would be struck by his bush hogging. According to Kirkland, quote, "I looked around for kids and other things around in the yard because the mower is bad about throwing big chunks of wood out from under it." And then he added that, quote, "I didn't see anybody or anything while I was there." This takes us to the second problem for the state, which is the question of when Scott Kirkland was outside the double-wide trailer and for how long. First, here's Kirkland on when he arrived.
All right, now, Mr. Kirkland, can you give us some type of time frame for when you started that operation there near Mr. Carnley's residence?
It was approximately 1 o'clock.
Approximately 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
And then, here's Kirkland on how long he was there.
Now, Mr. Kirkland, how long would you say you worked there in the area, in the vicinity of Alan Carnley's residence?
It wasn't long. There wasn't much mowing there. I'd say less than 5 minutes.
So Scott Kirkland arrived at 1 o'clock and bush hogged for 5 minutes. Does it make sense that AJ would have been outside the trailer from roughly 1 to 105 on the day Adriana drowned? Let's go back to his timeline. AJ said he was inside during the spraying incident and also inside for Adriana coming out of her room to watch TV. Then, as you may recall, he said he was asleep or pretending to be asleep in the living room when Adriana slammed the cabinet doors in the kitchen. And just to put a button on it, here's AJ telling the police that Adriana and he never went outside until their mom woke up this final time.
Did you and Adriana go outside today?
Not when mom was asleep.
What about when she got up?
Yes, sir.
And of course, we know what AJ says happened when Amanda was awoken by Adriana by slamming the cabinet doors. Amanda dunked Adriana to punish her. Adriana went to the nearby bus stop or park. Amanda told AJ to get her car keys and sandals. Amanda drove to get Adriana. There was a struggle on the way back, and then Amanda fatally dunked Adriana. Recall again that the 911 call in this case was at about 2:36 p.m. If we work back from that endpoint, 1.05 p.m. is an hour and a half before that emergency call. It certainly seems like the sequence of events that AJ described is much shorter than 90 minutes. That would mean that AJ was still in the trailer at 1:05 p.m. On the other hand, if AJ's stated sequence of events did start before 1:05, shouldn't Scott Kirkland have seen a big commotion at the trailer based upon being a witness to either the first dunking or its aftermath? But instead, he said he saw nothing at all. In the end, all this leads to the clear conclusion that AJ in his police statement and on the witness stand was not describing the day Adriana drowned, but instead the day before when the trees were actually being cut. Now, after Larry Basford tried to anchor AJ's memory with the tree cutting, he had him step away from the witness stand to look at a blown-up photo of his home and yard, to try to take him back to the supposed scene of the crime. Then, Basford unveiled a drawing of the drowning made by AJ himself to try to trigger his memory.
Now, first of all, do you recognize this?
Yes, sir.
Who made this?
I did.
Okay. Now, I see some writing on here. Did you write that on here?
Yes.
Where did you make this? Do you remember where you made this? Were you visiting Miss Lynette one day when you made this drawing?
Yes, sir. Okay.
The Miss Lynette whom Basford referenced is Lynette Hornsby, a mental health therapist who began counseling AJ in the wake of the drowning. She actually sat next to him as he testified at trial. She also saw him on January 24th, 2008, about 5.5 months after the drowning. Here, she explains how the drawing in question came about.
On January 24th, I was seeing AJ during a therapy session, and AJ and I were reading a book termed Brave Bart, and it's about getting over being frightened or scared. And I asked him, could he tell me of a time he had been scared? And he shook his head no, and I was not able to get him to talk that much that day. And I asked him, would he be willing to draw a picture of a time he was scared? And I offered him a piece of construction paper and a box of crayons, and he began drawing, and he completed that picture for me.
So Basford showed AJ this drawing, and it was displayed to the jury. It depicts Amanda dunking Adriana in the pool. There's a stick figure drawing of Adriana in the pool with an arrow pointing to her and the words, "My sister." And then there's a stick figure drawing of Amanda outside the pool with her right arm extended and covering Adriana's face. There's an arrow pointing to Amanda's right arm and the words, "My mom's arm." Elsewhere, there's a drawing of some trees with a stick figure in one of them, and an arrow points to the stick figure along with the letters AJ. There's also a note that says, "A bunch of trees where I am." The specific tree AJ said he was in was a short tree in front of the trailer that the family called the garbage can tree because it had a garbage can next to it. After Larry Basford showed AJ his drawing, AJ told the story of where he was when Adriana drowned, and it largely lined up with what he drew, as well as this audio clip of what he told police officers during his interrogation.
Would you climb a tree today?
The tree that I was already in. It was a short tree. It was this big.
What was Adriana doing?
Screaming. And she kept on getting dunked. And then I got out the tree. Because mom told me to go get Adriana. And then I found her dead in the pool. And I had to go get her.
Why didn't you go to get her?
Because my mom told me to.
So, you hear what happened here, right? AJ said that he was in the tree when he heard Adriana drowning. Around the same time, his mom told him to get his sister. And then he found Adriana in the pool. It certainly sounds like AJ didn't see the drowning and merely made up what he thought had happened based upon seeing Adriana lifeless in the pool. Of course, that leaves the question of whether AJ could see the pool from the garbage can tree, and everyone agrees that the answer is no. For instance, here was testimony by Alan Carnley, who was Amanda's boyfriend and owned the trailer where they lived.
And what is this tree over here?
That's the dogwood tree.
Okay, and what is there by the...
That's the garbage can.
Garbage can.
Yes.
If AJ referred to a garbage can tree, what would he be referring to?
That would be it. That's the only tree in the front yard.
Okay.
And this is a 2D picture of the pool. Can you see the pool from the garbage can tree?
No.
This caused some serious problems for the state's case, which was why Bassford basically scrambled to try and establish that AJ saw the drowning. He eventually got AJ to testify that, at some point, AJ got out of the tree and walked to the front corner of the trailer, where it's still debatable whether he could have seen the pool.
Where were you when you saw your sister die, or when your sister died? Where were you? You were here in this tree?
Yes, sir.
Did you stay in the tree, or did you move anywhere?
I moved.
Where did you move to? Right here?
Yes, sir.
At the corner here?
Yes, sir.
But what's not clear in AJ's testimony is when he got out of the tree. As you might recall, AJ testified that he was in the garbage can tree when Amanda told him to get his sister, which was followed by AJ finding his sister in the pool. In fact, this was the eighth part of his core story. But if AJ had already gotten out of the tree and walked over to watch the drowning, how could he still be in the tree when Amanda told him to get down from the tree to get his sister? It doesn't make much sense, but what does seem clear is that Larry Bassford tried to convince AJ that he had seen the drowning just after AJ testified that he had not. Here's a Q&A that occurred just before the testimony about going to the corner of the trailer.
When this was happening, could you see it?
No, sir.
Was that a yes or a no?
Yes.
In case AJ's first response wasn't clear from the audio, the court reporter who was there for this testimony transcribed it as no, meaning AJ could not see Adriana drowning or being drowned. Not liking that answer, Bassford followed up by asking whether that was a yes or a no. And you can hear AJ answering yes, more as a question than an answer, seemingly realizing that this is what Bassford wanted him to say, despite initially answering no. But beyond AJ's testimony, we also have something else in the drawing that AJ did for Lynette Hornsby. Right there, next to AJ in the garbage can tree, AJ wrote, "Can't see," clearly indicating that he could not see what was happening with his sister in the pool.
Of course, that drawing was made 5.5 months after the drowning, so you might discount it. On the other hand, it was made in the friendly environment of therapy, rather than the two police officers in an interrogation room hours after his sister had died. But what would be absolutely perfect would be an accounting by AJ on the day of the drowning in another friendly environment. And guess what? There was. But the state didn't want the jury to hear about it. As noted, the police interrogation of AJ started at 5.09 p.m. on the day Adriana drowned. After that, perhaps realizing that police interrogating a 6-year-old witness without a child specialist was a terrible idea, AJ was taken that night to the Gulf Coast Children's Advocacy Center. There at 8.30 p.m., he was interviewed for about an hour by Sarah Campbell, a member of the Child Protection Team.
Tell the jury what the Child Protection Team is, what function you serve in the community.
We are available to interview children in regards to many different things, and we also provide medical evaluations, psychosocial and psychological evaluations.
And do you yourself have any special training in regard to interviewing young children?
Yes, sir.
That's defense counsel Walter Smith doing direct examination of Sarah Campbell because, yep, prosecution chose not to call her at trial. That's right. The state decided it was not in its interest to call the one neutral and trained witness who had interviewed AJ. In fact, the state fought tooth and nail to prevent Campbell from testifying to what AJ told her, and it's easy to see why.
In the interview, did you ask him specifically if he actually saw his sister getting dumped?
I did.
And what was his answer?
Objection.
So yeah, The state objected to this testimony, with the back and forth on this issue taking up about 4 pages of the trial transcript. The nature of this objection was like Liar Liar, the movie in which Jim Carrey's attorney, who can only tell the truth, objects at trial.
Your Honor, I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
Overruled.
Good call!
Simply put, AJ testified at trial. The prosecution played portions of his police interrogation to the jury. Of course Campbell could testify about what AJ told her that same night. And here's what he said.
Do you remember the question?
I do not.
Okay. I asked you, if I recall, whether during the interview you asked AJ specifically, did he see his sister getting dunked or drowned?
I did.
And what was his response to that question?
AJ denied seeing her get dunked.
Okay. Did he ever, was he able to place himself at a location outside the home while his sister was apparently drowning?
He was.
And where did he place himself?
He placed himself at the garbage can tree.
Yep. Just like he wrote in his drawing, AJ told Sarah Campbell that he didn't see the drowning. As you might expect, this testimony was the centerpiece of the defense counsel's closing argument.
And that's the garbage can tree, and there's pictures of it. And you cannot see the pool from the garbage can tree, but yet, over and over again, he says this is where he's playing, either in the tree or around the tree. He couldn't possibly have seen it. And he has said as much. He has said, not only in court he didn't see it, he told the CPT people he didn't see it. Well, if he didn't see it and he's telling you what happened, what does that amount to? That amounts to a story. That amounts to a tale. That amounts to something he thinks happened, but he really didn't see it. He's just filling in the blanks.
Now, that's not to say that Campbell's testimony was totally unhelpful to the state. Indeed, she testified that AJ told her the same general story about Adriana misbehaving, the first dunking, Adriana going to the park, and Amanda bringing her back and dunking her a second time. But again, even this rendition of this core story ends with AJ being in the garbage can tree during the drowning and not being able to see it.
So when she got done dunking her, she told her to go to the park until she gets over there. Adriana told her mother she did not want to go to the park, but her mother sent her. His mother left to get Adriana from the park and return home. AJ was standing on the steps of the house when his mother returned with Adriana. AJ stated, so when she came come up the driveway, Adriana was crying, so she was trying to escape from Mama. My mama pulled Adriana back into the car and said, you ain't going to escape from me. So she throwed Adriana in the pool, and she told her, if you don't scoop out the bugs, I'm going to dunk you. AJ was near the garbage can tree playing with his tractors when his mother dunked Adriana in the pool. He denied he saw his mother dunk Adriana in the pool.
Now, none of this is to say that Campbell described AJ telling a consistent and coherent story. For example, here's Campbell testifying regarding what AJ told her without any prompting about how many times Adriana had been dunked.
During the course of the interview, how many times, did you ask him how many times his sister got dunked?
I don't know if I specifically asked him how many times. It was stated by AJ that she was dunked 4 times.
4 times.
This was also a pretty big point of emphasis at trial, that AJ even changed his story about how many times Adriana had been dunked. The defense argued this was further evidence that AJ didn't know what had happened and was simply coming up with different stories to explain the drowning. Beyond AJ's shifting story, as we'll discuss in more detail in a later episode, the state tried to paint Amanda as a cold-blooded mother who tried to scare Adriana by dunking her and then showed no remorse after things got out of hand. But that narrative was very much contradicted by Campbell's testimony at trial about what AJ had told her.
Now, after his sister was discovered in the swimming pool, did he describe what his mother did upon being alerted to the fact that his sister was in the pool?
He did.
Okay, and how did he describe his mother? What did he say his mother was doing?
He made a motion as if his mother threw up.
As if his mother was throwing up?
Yes, sir.
He didn't say that in words, did he?
No, sir.
And then finally, you might recall that first responder Charles Corcoran testified to the bruise in Adriana's head. As we'll see in a later episode, the bruising on Adriana's head became a pretty big point of contention at trial. If AJ was right that Amanda dunked Adriana, could the bruising have been from Amanda's fingers? Could it have come from Adriana accidentally falling into the pool and hitting her head, as Charles Corcoran first suspected? Or did it come from AJ, who came across Adriana lifeless in the pool and tried to make her move?
Did he also mention throwing a white bucket at his sister?
Yes, sir.
And tell me how that came up. What specifically did he say about a white bucket?
AJ said, would you like the whole quote?
Go ahead. Yeah, tell us exactly what you remember about the white bucket.
This is his quote. So when I went over there, I got in the wagon, so I threw the white bucket at her. She wasn't moving at all. She was just floating.
In the end, none of these inconsistencies and issues in AJ's story made much of a difference to the jury. After deliberating for only under 2 hours, including a lunch break, they returned a guilty verdict.
State of Florida versus Amanda Elaine Lewis, case number 07-282-CF. Verdict. We, the jury, find as follows as to the defendant, Amanda Elaine Lewis, as to count one in this case. The defendant is guilty as charged of first-degree felony murder.
But did the jury get it right? Amanda Lewis testified in her defense at trial and gave a very different version of events than AJ. And Amanda, Adriana, and AJ weren't alone in the trailer that afternoon. There was a fourth witness who would testify at trial. And Scott Kirkland wasn't the only one who drove by the trailer on the day of the drowning. There was a neighbor who passed by mere minutes before Amanda's 911 call, but the jury never heard from him. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got two additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. In addition to that, we also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at RabiaSquared2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.